they had to get home. They were told in Fairley House that the rising had started in Dublin because it started on the Angelus Bell, and they had to get back then to Patrick Street. And it was very dangerous, you know. It was all pony and traps then. There were very few cars.
Yeah.
And, of course, then during the Black and Tans time. When
were they at any stage harassed or threatened or raided?
Well,
or?
They would be. And, you see, my mother always told me that when the soldiers were after anyone, they would run up the stairs up to our bedrooms was at the side of the shop. And they'd run up the stairs through the windows and out onto the roofs and get away because they knew the area. And there was, I think, was four or six shops down because there were all shops along there, along Clanbrassil Street as well. There was a Mrs. Doody, and she was a great IRA woman. As a matter of fact, I don't know whether I should say this or not. They sent you to pay the IRA from her shop.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, so the funds for the organisation came in there.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that interesting, no?
Yeah. And I tell you something more interesting. Mm. She hid them in the bottle of a milk churn.
Did she? That's where the money was kept, is it? Yeah. And the volunteers would come in and mm-hmm. or they would get...
I'd say they would.
So quite an important place. And what was her name? Do you know the woman that you just met? She was in
Mrs. Doody.
Doody in Cumann na Mban, wasn't it? Was she was a member of Cumann
na Mban? Doody, Doody. And she sold bread mostly.
Yeah.
They had a shop, and milk, of course, and butter, most things like that, because the Ivy Flats were opposite. And that's how my father made his money really too, from the Ivy Flats, because although the people were poor, they were very honest.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't owe you halfpenny. You know, they were very, very honest. And I'll tell you a story about, there was a woman came into my father's shop and she said, "Mr. O'Neill, my son has got a job on the docks." And there's terrible poverty and there were very few jobs. And she says, "He's got a job on the docks," she said, "but I've nothing for his breakfast." And she said, "There's sixpence. Would you give me enough for his breakfast?" And of course, my father knew exactly how she felt. So he gave. He didn't give her over or above or anything because she wouldn't have that. So he gave her the halfpenny loaf, a half an ounce of tea because tea was so light you got a lot, sugar, butter and bread for the sixpence. And off she went, delighted with herself. And I think he gave her cheese as well for the breakfast. Yes.
What was the inner city Dublin like in those days? Was it derelict looking or was it
no.
rough? And...
No, I don't think so. I think it was like anywhere else. Now, my brothers belonged to what they called their gang, you know. And then there was the Hannigan gang. Now, I don't know whether you wouldn't have known about the Hannigans, but their grandmother had a stall in the market. But she made so much money that she paid for her two grandsons to be educated in university, and they both became doctors. So there was a Dr. Joe Hannigan and another, can't remember his brother's name. But my brother would always talk about, we take those, the Hannigan gang, they wouldn't fight them. You know? And they had their own gang they kept together because my brother Gerard and my father, they were Republicans, but never said so because you daren't say you were Republican then. But he went to the Irish class. And you didn't say you were going to an Irish class with the soldiers around. If they stopped you and said, "Where are you going?" you had to tell a lie, say something else. But he got his gold fawn, yeah. And my brother Tommy, who was, I suppose, 8 years younger than Gerard, at that time, for confirmation, they would get their confirmation wearing kilts. You know, anyone who could afford to buy the kilts made a confirmation in kilts. And of course, our Tommy, because my father had the shop, you see, and had, well, he was fairly good at the time. And Tommy made his confirmation in kilts. And I, strangely enough, my cousin married a man from Inchicore. And the first thing I noticed when I went to visit them was that he had a photograph of himself, a 10-year-old, on the sideboard, and he was wearing kilts. And she said, "That's Tim's confirmation photograph." Was that a coincidence, you know?
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. And that was a tradition at the time, to wear a kilt.
To wear a kilt for your confirmation.
Confirmation.
Yeah. And, of course, Irish dancers wore the kilts as well, the saffron-coloured kilts for Irish dancing.
Yeah. Could you tell me about yourself? Where did you go to school?
I went to school in St. Mary's National School on the Green Hills Road. And I went to what they call the old school. It was there from it was before 1920 would have been built. And it was very small. And I know we had a gallery for the up to 2-year-olds. You know, steps all up along at the end of the school. It was called the gallery. And then we had a two-teacher school, Miss Wogan and Miss Little. And then they wanted a new school. And, of course, the parish priests were in charge of the schools. So Father McNevin said that if we got 70 on the roll, he would give us a new school. So, of course, everyone then was asked by Miss Wogan, if you had a young brother or a young sister, bring them to school to get a new school, because that was his promise. If she got 70, he'd give her a new school. So, of course, my little brother was only 3. Now, at this stage, we lived in Cookstown, which the Cookstown Industrial Estate beside the square. And he was 3. And we carried him, my sister and I, May, who's Mary, and myself. We used to carry him between us to school, to get the new school. And he used to say, "Carry me, I'm not able to walk."
But you were all determined that
Well, we were determined to get a new school, especially the teacher, because we loved the teachers. May and I, we loved school. I know, and all my brothers and sisters seemed to like school as well, except one, Tommy. He left school at 14. He thought he'd never come to 14 to leave school. He was the only one. The others, Gerard went to Ternio College, and I think Michael went to Black Rock for a year or two. I'm not quite sure of that, because they never spoke much about
it. Well,
that
was in the 20s. What about Irish in school in those days? Do you remember being taught Irish in school?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And we got a great grounding in Irish. So much so that, like, we knew Irish. We were really good at Irish when we were in school. And a friend of mine, she became an Irish typist in the Dáil. And she said only for the grounding she got in Talla National School, because she went there too before she went on for higher education. She said she'd never would have got that job.
Mm-hmm. Living out in Talla at that time, did you find yourself cut off from the city, or did you find yourself you were way out in the country?
Oh, yes. Oh, it was rural. Very much so. And I mean,
and a trip into Dublin, would that happen often?
Not very often, no. And I had a sister, and she lived most of her time, when she came home for weekends, but she was working for my uncle in Francis Street. He had a shop there. And he had 3 shops in all. And she used to stay with an aunt in Drumcondra, because of the long journey, you see, and she come home on weekends, and she loved, and she used to say to us when we were young, "Don't say you're going to Dublin. That's real country. Say you're going to town."
Do you remember the trams?
Oh, I do. Well, my sister and I went, and we to make our confirmation on the Dublin to Blessington steam tram. Now, we lived in Cookstown at that time. And most of the Talla people around all went on the tram.
What are your memories of the tram?
Well, I know that it was lovely to get on and to go into. It only went as far as Town Muir, the steam tram. And then you got the electric tram down into the city. And I used to go, my mother used to bring me into Uncle Tom's, as we called him, in Francis Street, you know, or Moore Street. He had Francis Street, Moore Street and James Street shops. He had three shops. And we used to go to Francis Street, and we always then got brought upstairs and got tea and whatever was going.
Francis Street was always known as a great place for dealing. There was always...
Oh, the dealers were outside the shop.
And were they outside the shop?
Oh, they were outside the shop, yeah.
Yeah. Can you describe it to me your early days?
I don't remember the dealers that much, but my sister, Sadie, Lord Merson, she's dead since, she always remembers them and remembers the man selling lavender outside. And they would buy, you see, my uncle, I don't think, sold fruit at that time. And they would get the fruit from the dealers. But they were on both sides of the street, Francis Street and Moore Street.
So much buzz. I'm sure that it was a very busy and very colourful street in
the, oh, yes.
With its characters as well, yeah, as the steelers.
Yes, yeah. And the shouts of, you see, to us who lived in the country, the shouts of them, you know, selling their wares, the orange, the apples and all. It was fantastic to go into town. Now, I remember always being brought to town for my birthday, and my mother would go to the Metropole for our lunch and bring me. But I would never eat out. I was a very bad eater when I was young. And she would get me ice cream or something. But I always remember she would have a full meal, you know, and eat it all. And I used to envy her, you know, the way she'd be able to eat it all, because I was such a bad eater. But even so, she would never force you to eat. Like, if she said you only wanted tea and toast, well, you'd get tea and toast. She'd never say, which you might say, try to eat something else, and why don't you some? But you were never forced to eat anything like that. I mean, she was that kind, you know.
And shopping in the town with your mother, what were the streets, apart from going up Francis Street and Moore Street, where else in Dublin would your mother go?
Oh, Cleary's. And my father would shop in Cleary's. Now, my father always bought us our shoes and coats, because they were expensive. So he would always buy those for us. And he always said, buy the best. It's cheapest in the end, because it will last the longest. And that was his
good advice.
Good advice, yeah.
Yeah. But with the shop windows, what do you remember? Was there a lot of attention paid to decorating the shop windows?
Oh, very much so. And there were always just so many things in the shop windows, especially clothes, I remember. The clothes would be, the windows would be dressed out, you know, maybe just one model in the window and a few things. And I always remember going into town, because there was a Mrs. Mooney lived opposite us. Well, I won't say opposite. They had a big farm in Fettercairn, Mooney's. And she used to do Switzer's window, the windows in Switzer's with flowers, you know, for some of the time. And I remember someone said to me, Mrs. Mooney has done the windows in Switzer's. And I went into town. Now, that this time we had buses, and I went into town to see the window. And I remember it was an autumn scene, and she'd beautiful autumn leaves and all the autumn colours among the models, like in Switzer's windows.
Beautifully dressed out.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And what about the workers in the shops? Were they, how different were they to what today?
Oh, they were very different.
Now?
I mean, you know, they were there to please you. and they would help you. And as soon as you'd come, they would ask to help you. And what had you in mind? And had you any particular colour or a make or whatever? They were so different. And I remember my sister Sadie and I was, now at this stage, I suppose I would have been 17 or 18, maybe 19. I'd finished school anyway. And she, being a city person, my sister Sadie, she was always well up in fashion. And she dressed beautifully always. And she said to me, I said about buying a suit, you see, for summer. And she says, well, the time to buy it, she said, is, you know, February or March, or even in April, but February or March with the two, because she said, all the clothes are coming into the shops and you have the pick. Oh, she was very clever altogether. So I remember going to, I think it was Todd Burns in Mary Street. And, it, you know, we were walking along that, and she says, there's your suit. And she saw the suit in the window. And we went in. And when we went in, the coat was, the jacket or coat, whichever they like, the jacket and skirt it was perfect on me as fit. But the skirt was very big on the hips. So she, the girl said, oh, that's easily remedied. She says, we'll make you a new skirt because it's far too big for you. And you see, I was very small because I was a bad eater. So then I was small. And I remember she said, we said we'd pay for it, you see. And she said, oh, we'll take the jacket because we want to match it up with something else. And I said to her, when we came out, you see, with the jacket, I said, what's the something else? Well, we haven't much money to buy anything else at the moment. Hmm. Well, she said, you know, they could always sell that jacket to someone else and make you a new jacket, and you probably wouldn't notice the difference. But she said the cut on that jacket was made for a show. So she said, I remembered to take the jacket.
She obviously had a good eye.
Oh, yes, yes, she really had. But she was my model, really, as regards clothes.
Pat, could you tell me, in politics in Dublin, the 1931 election, do you remember De Valera, for the first time, Fianna Fáil got into power? What was the excitement around? And do you remember going to political meetings, or were you brought by your parents, or do you remember at any stage anything happening?
Well, I remember when they, but of course, politics was always mentioned in our house. We were Fianna Fáil, and we had cousins who were Fine Gael. And when we'd meet, you know, because we always visited, my mother had three sisters married and a brother married. And we always kept in touch. We visited each other most of the time. And there'd be always great arguments. And I always remember listening. And I always felt that my brother came out on top. Fianna Fáil, you see. They were able to argue their corner, as it were. And then when Fianna Fáil got into power, Sean McEntee was for the area, and he promised the people in Clondalkin that he would open the mill if they put him into power. Now, the mill had been closed for years, Clondalkin paper mills, and there was a lot of poverty around. Now, we had Ernie Chocolates, which gave great, it's the only place around that gave employment. And I remember when they got into power, they said that there was great excitement that Sean McEntee and someone else was coming to Clondalkin for a big rally, you see, big victory rally, and that he was coming the Belgard Road and into Talla for a victory rally, another one, you know.
Yes.
And we, someone said they were going to light tar barrels. And you see, at that time, what was I, 10? Yeah, 21. I would have been 10. And I remember coming across the aerodrome to stand at the side of the aerodrome, because the Belgard Road is the side of the Old Tal aerodrome, and we lived on the Old Tal aerodrome, and coming across to the Belgard Road behind the wire there, and we all coming across there to see the cavalcade going by, and there were tarbards lit from Newlands Cross to the Belgard Road.
Really?
All the way, yeah.
Right.
And you see, you know, you get the tar barrels from the council. There was so much tar left in the bottom of the barrels after they were emptied, you see, so the flame would be there. And there were tar barrels lit all the way. We had a fantastic time. And of course, being Fianna Fáil supporters, it was great, really great. And I'm a supporter ever since.
Well, you know, the following year, in 1932, you had the Eucharistic Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And did you go to that?
No, I didn't go. But although I had my confirmation made, I wasn't supposed to have it made because the date was changed and I wasn't 10 until the March. I wasn't 10. It was supposed to be in February. The confirmation, and I wasn't 10 until March, and it was at that time that the names were taken for everyone in the school that was to go to the Eucharistic Congress. So my sister May, she went, but I couldn't go. And as a matter of fact, we were late waking the morning that she was to go down to get the school bus into the Phoenix Park. And Gerard, my eldest brother, who had a motorbike, and my next brother, Michael, had a motorbike, powerful bikes. He had a Rudge, and he decided he'd take May into the Phoenix Park on the bike. So she dressed up and into the Phoenix Park on the bike. Now, whether she found the school or not, I don't know, but I know that she got and he got the Eucharistic Congress.
Was there loads of excitement around?
Oh, yes, very much so. Because especially all those who had made their confirmation, you see, were all going.
Oh, I see.
Into the Phoenix Park by bus from the school.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very exciting time. And of course, that time then, every house had a picture afterwards of the Eucharistic Congress.
They all decorated their front windows.
Didn't in Cookstown. I think the village did.
Yeah.
In yellow and white, you know, bunting and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then
continuing all the way through the 30s, they were, for the farmers anyway, they were tough because of the.
They had to pay annuities to the British. For the land.
And then you had the economic war out of that.
Yeah. Because that was killing them. They hadn't the money, you see, to pay. But they had to pay or the land was taken back. So in that way, De Valera promised that he would do away with the land annuities if they put him into power. And he did.
And
he kept that promise.
But did it affect It didn't affect your family at the time.
No. No, not really, because my father was on, he would have been on a wage when he'd be on carpentry and joinery at the time. But I never remember my father to be idle. He loved his work.
But you were at this stage, you were still living with your parents at home.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So did you experience, was money tighter? Was your father finding it difficult to get work at that time?
I don't know. You see, he had three brothers and himself and his father who lived in Blackrock. They all lived in Blackrock at that time before they were married. And my mother told me that his brother Tom, everyone in Dublin wanted him to do work for them. You see, they must have had a good name. My father was the same. Everything had to be perfect. He was a perfectionist in his work.
And the type of work he was doing now, was he making furniture, or was he involved in domestic work in doors?
Yeah, and
doors
and windows.
And architrave and shutters.
And he'd worked like new houses which were started. Now, he worked on Mount Marion Avenue all the houses along there. And his brother Tom would be the same. And then he had a brother Lawrence. And, you know, they were, everyone wanted them because their name must have been good.
No problem getting jobs.
No problem getting work. I never remember him to be idle because he said, well, there was nine of us, so we couldn't afford it. Couldn't afford to be idle. But I suppose money was tight, but we never felt it so because we always had enough. You know, we always seemed to have enough.
And growing up with so many brothers and sisters in the house, you all got on okay together?
I mean, there was great. No... Well, I suppose we had our arguments. But it was great to have older brothers and they'd look after us. And Jared in particular, and Michael, I suppose, they were great to know because any question I would ask them, they seemed to know the answer. And to me, they were fantastic. You know, to have brothers like that was great. And sisters. And we went everywhere together. We'd wait for one another. You know, maybe if it was late coming home at night, we would meet up and be home together. You know, my father and my mother used to tell us that, wait on one another. And the boys maybe would come and pick us up with the motorbikes and bring us home.
And where did you go? Where would you go?
Mostly Doyle's Hall, which was at the top of Talla Village. And other times then we'd go into town. Now, I would be older now, over 20. And we go to Cleary's Ballroom. And we go to the Crystal Ballroom. And we go to the Four Provinces in the afternoon. We all loved dancing, our family, as besides having friends who also danced. Because that was the only thing. You know, there'd be house dances. And one of the places where the last house dance was people by the name of Mansfield. And there were four cottages where the square is now. And the four cottages were knocked down to make way for the square. And in the 1st of February was known as the Breathog or St. Bridget's Day. And there would always be a house dance somewhere on that night, the night before. And the last place to hold what we call the Breathog dance was that family of Mansfields. There were five or six girls there and one boy.
And was it customary to dress up? Did you dress up?
No, not really. Well, you dressed in your best it was a Breathog. Apparently, now I don't remember that much of it, only to hear about it and some of the family would go. But apparently they dressed up the brush to look like St. Bridget. And that'd be in the corner. Now, I don't remember seeing that. Mm-hmm. Because I was never at one of those dances, but my sisters would tell me about it.
Yeah, but in other parts of the country, it's known as Biddy's Day, and they would go around and knock at doors and put on a costume and sing and that wasn't
they
the
didn't
case.
That no they always had a dance in someone's house, and I think they paid a shilling or something to get tea and biscuits or tea or whatever, or maybe to pay for the music, I don't know, but they paid about a shilling or 2 shillings at the time, and they all went to this particular house, and that was where they celebrated the Breathog, as they called it.
What about the other seasonal times, Christmas and Easter, and for example, how was Christmas celebrated?
Well, we lived in Cookstown then, and of course, Christmas was a lovely time. And we were brought to town. My father would bring us into Dublin and buy us something, you know, for Christmas, buy us a Christmas box, as he called it. And also, when I was young, you always hung up your stocking. And the one thing which you looked forward to was getting an orange and the toe of the stocking, because oranges weren't very plentiful. or any fruit, really, especially fruit that had to come in, like bananas and grapes and oranges. And my father would go into town to buy them. They wouldn't be available in the shops around. Well, there was only one or two shops. But fruit wouldn't be available because it wouldn't keep, you see. It wouldn't be a good buy for the shops. So you wouldn't get that. And my father would go into town and get these things because when he started the shop in Patrick Street, he always bought his stuff in the market there in, you know, the market of Smithfield.
Yes,
Smithfield?
It would be
the fish
quite
market
close,
and the fruit market were together.
Yeah.
And they're still there, and I still go to and collect flowers now for the priory and the oratory. But he always bought, you know, the things there. So he knew he would still go back to the market and maybe buy a small crate of oranges or some grapes and all. But he would go to the market for it because he had his friends there still and they would give him what he wanted, smaller quantities, you know, for us.
Have you got any memory of farmers going there with their produce?
Oh, yes. Mr. Mooney of Fetacairn, they always went with their produce there. And we would hear the horses' hooves. You know, if you're awake early in the morning, especially in the summer, because we lived that near, that you would hear the horse and cart going up the Belgard Road, up by Fortune's Town and on into the market. They went in by Ballymount. And on in that way. And that would be about 4 or 5 in the morning. You'd hear them going to market. And old Mr. Mooney had the biggest size cauliflowers in the market. Everyone wanted his cauliflowers. And the reason he gave when, I think later on that we got to know him so well, he said that he always sowed his cauliflowers in what he called the river field. And it was the moisture from the river that had the cauliflowers big.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Yes. Mm. And farmers that would go into the market with their produce, they were big farmers, were
mm-hmm.
they?
Mm.
And who were they? You had, do you know who they were, the names of the farmers?
Well, you would have Mooney's, Kavanagh's, Dowd sometimes. I don't know whether they brought their stuff to the market. They were mostly dairy farmers, I think. And you would have, I think Kennedy's were near Tala. And most of the others were dairy farmers. You see, all the farmers weren't produce farmers. A lot of them were dairy farmers. And there was Masterson's, which was in Ballymount, but they were dairy farmers. It was all milch cows they had.
Yeah.
And I think there were Flynn's from Killinarden. I think they were dairy farmers too. The only one really, the big one, was Patrick Mooney.
Hmm.
And another little thing about him was that when Tato started to come to Ireland from America, Tato crisps. That was 50 years ago because it was said on the radio. It's 50 years ago. He was the one, they sent out a notice that they to tender for the potatoes to make the crisps. They were made down in Harold's Cross, before you go to Harold's Cross, in a factory there. And he was the one who tendered for the potatoes, for the crisps. You see, and he had to give a guarantee that he would provide them with so much potatoes every week. He had to give that guarantee to get the tender. You see, because he knew he had money coming in all the time, so long as he had potatoes. So he won the tender. And I remember my brother Tommy saying to his son, Paddy, but what happens if you haven't got enough potatoes for sending them in, you see? Because they had to send in potatoes to be checked as well, to see what they were like. And Paddy says, sure, we'll get them from another farmer.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. You had Jacobs came out here some time ago, and now they're closing again. Mm-hmm. But you remember them coming
I
in
do,
here, do you?
Yeah. Now, I worked in Arnie then, Arnie Chocolates.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
And they were quite there was up to 300 people working there, wasn't there?
In Arnie?
Yeah.
Well, at one time we had just 1,000 people in Arnie.
Did you have up to 1,000?
Yes, yeah.
My goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
And
a managing director called Mr. Thomas Hayden. Mm-hmm. And he had great plans for it. And we had up to 1,000. And he was a rugby player. He played for London Irish. Now, we did come, I think, from London to Arnie. I'm not sure when he came back. Now, he lived on Grace Park Road, you know, in Drumcondra, as far as I know. But he had great plans for Arnie, and he was going to send Arnie chocolates all over the world. And he got so stout, he decided to walk every Sunday. And his wife used to leave him at the end of one of the hills, you know, the Talla Hills, and he would walk up and back, and she would come back in an hour and collect him. And he wasn't doing it for long, and he died. He took a heart attack and died. And that was the end of, like, the plans.
Yeah.
Now, it carried on, but no one seemed to have the same initiative.
Not the same drive,
had.
Yeah.
No, no.
What age were you when you went in?
Well, I went to, from Talla School, we went to, there were three of us, we went to Rathmines High School of Commerce when I was 15 then. And my friends were, oh, the same. Yeah, one was 15. I think the other was 15. There were three of us went. And we wanted to be shorthand typists, because that was the coming thing for girls then. You got good monies, whatever. And we didn't aspire to anything else, not university or anything. We thought that would be good if we could get there. And in my last year there, which was third year, now the other two had left, but in my last year, I got TB. I'm a survivor of the famous TB that ravaged Dublin so much in 1939. And there were up to...
Were you in sanatorium for a while?
6 months. Where? Sorry, 4 months.
Where was that?
Piemont. I went to Piemont because the doctor said to my mother, said, I nearly guarantee you that I'd cure her if you let her go to Piemont, she said. I can treat her there. And she said, now this was Dr. Barry, the famous Dr. Barry at that time. And she said that she would give me 12, which was called gold dust injections at the time. Now, afterwards, I think it was known as streptomycin. Someone told me that. But she said it was gold dust injections. And, of course, I thought that was great. It never bothered me. People said, were you not sad? I said I was sad leaving my family. But I wasn't that sad.
Yeah.
It wasn't the end of the world for me to go to Piemont, because it was so near that all my family came on a Sunday to see me, with the exception of my mother, and she came every Wednesday. So I had family on a Sunday and family on a Wednesday. So that was great.
And that went on for four months.
For 4 months, yeah.
And did many of your contemporaries get TB at the time?
There were 13 to 14 people, as far as I know. I'm always trying to make out how many names there were who died in Talla from TB.
All around your age, young?
Yeah, yeah. Mostly 19. Mm-hmm. 18, 19. And I was 19 when I got it.
And it was a big worry, I'm sure, to your parents, but also Generally, was it a worry? Because it was an epidemic at the
Oh, it
time.
was, because you see, it was an epidemic and people were saying the government weren't doing enough. And then someone else said that Crookes Lane, you see, was a TB sanatorium. And there was a Dr. Lydon in Tala at the time. And he said the germs were coming down on the air to Tala. And he like, people then began to think that that's why so many people died in Tala. It was from Crookes Lane. Now, it's a women's home now, mostly for Alzheimer's. Crookes Lane, it was a sanatorium, but it's now St. Bridget's, Crookes Lane.
And people thought that
the germs
were actually coming down.
Yeah, because the people from, the only other sanatorium, I think, in Dublin was Ringsend, the Pigeon House. And you were sent there to die. You know, if you were sent there, there was no hope. And apparently anyone who they thought would have hope would be sent from the Pigeon House to Crookes Lane to try and get better.
My goodness, yeah. And
then there was Piemont.
And Piemont. And in 1939, of course, was the beginning of the war years, too.
That's right.
So that was another difficult time.
Yes.
How did your family and yourself cope with the war years?
Well, I remember first when we heard the war had started, you see. My father was very fond of tea. He never drank or smoked. And very few of us drank. I didn't. I never drank. And very few of us, I mean, my brother would maybe take a drink, but my brother Michael was—he never broke his confirmation pledge. Most of us didn't, and tea was to him the best thing in the world. So I always remember he brought home this big tea caddy, you know, the old-fashioned tea caddies with the Chinese. They were black with Chinese around them, and they had a screw top. It was that height, and he filled that with tea. Now, we said, that'll do us till the war is over. But, of course, nobody realised the war was going to go on for 6 years, from 39 to 45. So, of course, I think at the second year, the tea was all gone. But I remember we used to get what we call shell cocoa. My father used to go for it, shell cocoa. I think it was in Guinness's. The shells from the cocoa bean or whatever they call it. And we used to boil that in a kettle. And I kept the kettle. That's the kettle there that we used to boil the shell cocoa in, because we hung it over a hook in the sitting room at night, you see, for the supper. Now, we wouldn't always have the fire lit in the sitting room in Cookstown, but we also had a range in the kitchen. And it went on the range. But on a Sunday night, my father always, you know, he had his own way of doing things. Everything like was a ritual. So Sunday, the fire was lit in the sitting room, and not so much in the summer, but the winter. And we all sat around the fire because we had the radio. And of course, you'd tell stories until you had the radio. And it was my brother, Jared and Michael, bought the radio. And when it came home, they had to put it together with all these fiddly things. They were all wrapped up in paper. And they had a big diagram to put it together. It was a square box, big one. And they had to follow the diagram and put it together. And of course, having gone to college, you see, they were very brainy. So the sitting room was always lit on a Sunday night. And we had no electricity, so it was run by battery. And we had to save the battery for Sunday night, usually, to hear Joe Linnane on Question Time and listen to the radio. And now I've digressed. What did you ask me first?
Yes. No, it's a lovely story. But going back to the tea,
the war
years.
The war years. Yes, well, you would be without most things, and especially brown paper, a piece of string. Everything had to be kept. Everything was precious. because you couldn't buy them after a while in the shops. You couldn't buy anything. As they ran out, you see, being neutral, we had to bring in most things into the country. And you see, you wouldn't get to buy then any of those because they weren't coming into the shops. What was coming in here was mostly food into the country. I mean, De Valera was neutral, but he said we wouldn't starve. And he compelled the farmers to grow the food, you know, potatoes and cabbage and what have you, turnips and whatever they had to buy. He compelled them and he fined them if they didn't. So that's how we survived during the war, that we didn't, we had most things, you know.
Yeah, and was it easy to get around because petrol was rationed as well?
That's right. Well, it wasn't easy. You just didn't get it. The only ones who got petrol were people in what they call the services. Now, my brother, Gerard and Tommy, they joined what was called the LDF, Local Defence Force. And most lads in Talla and around joined too. And what was his name? He was in charge of them. Tom Watkins. Now, he was the father of Kathleen Watkins.
Oh, yes.
Of the harp fame, married Gay Byrne. Well, Tom was over the LDF. He was a little bit, you know, he was good in stature-like. People looked up to him.
Yeah.
Because he did his bit during the war, like with the IRA and that sort of thing. Now, Kathleen doesn't always like that mentioned, but he did his bit during that raid at the bank in Blessington. We were told all this, of course. And but he was over the LDF and they joined the LDF. Now, those in the LDF would get a certain amount of petrol, you know, maybe a pint or whatever. And that would have to do you for ages. And then they brought out coupons and you got so much tea and so much sugar. But of course, it wouldn't be enough. And my mother used to go into her nephew in Clanbrassil Street. He had a shop there. And whatever friend he had a way of getting tea. And he sold it for £1. £1 note for £1 of tea. And that was a lot then. But she used to go in every week and buy £1 of tea. So we were never short of tea, except for the shell cocoa for our supper. You see, we had to save the tea, so the shell cocoa had to be put on the fire. And, of course, it was mostly shells, and then you'd fill up with water and boil it, and you got this stuff. It was awful. You'd rather drink water, which I often did. I wasn't fond of it. But I always remember my brother saying, that's what my father fed the pigs in Patrick Street with, he said. And of course, none of us would drink it after that.
And the bread wasn't too nice. It was black bread.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, but you survived. And my mother would get flour and bake because we had the range, you see, to bake in. And that time, of course, you eat what was in season, like apples, you know, and pears and blackberries. And she made pie. And one thing we always got, always seemed to come in, and that was rice. Now, rice was cheap. So, and it was good. So you had rice. And I always remember my brother Gerard saying one evening, what's for dessert, Mother? And he said, and before she had time to answer, he said, the never to be forgotten rice.
The dreaded rice.
No, it was lovely because she made it in the oven.
But all right. And how did she cook it then?
She cooked it in the oven. I think she cooked it in a pot first on the range. Then she put it in a big square dish in the oven. It was about that size. And then she would put an egg all over it. And this egg would brown. You see, it would brown on the top. And of course, we all wanted a bit of the brown. So she, I tell you, she had trouble dividing it out.
But generally, people those days, they were very careful.
There was a lot of poverty.
But there's
a lot of poverty in Talla Village.
Yes.
You know, I mean, people had no work. But I mean,
how did they manage?
I don't know, some of them. And, you know, the funny thing was that when I went to Talis Gould, they sort of thought that we were the same as they were. And you see, you couldn't say, like, that we were never without anything, you know, which we weren't. And they seemed to think, like, oh, you must have been poor. You were poor too. That's what they used to think at first. And I remember giving a talk up in Jobstown College too. There were fifth formers, you know, and one was at the end of it. I loved going up and, you know, it was about an hour. I talked for about an hour on all times in Tala. And at the end of it, the teacher said, there was a few minutes before the bell went, and she said, now, anyone can ask a question, but only one question. We've time for, she said, I think we've only one question of, I don't know whether she called me Pat or Miss O'Neill, but whoever, I think it was Pat, because I said to them to call me Pat. And she said, so quick, a quick question. And this fellow put up his hand and he said, were you rich? So, and of course, there's a lot of poverty up there around Jobstown now with all the council houses and the corporation houses. So, of course, I had to be careful. And I said, we were never rich. I said, no, we weren't rich. But I said, we never seemed to be short of anything. I said, I never remember my father to be idle. He always worked because there were nine of us. And that's the answer I gave him.
How long, Pat, did you spend in the factory when you were working in...
I was there 33 years.
That's a lifetime.
A lifetime, yeah. And I loved it.
And when you went in first, did you... What work were you doing there?
Well, when I applied to Orney, I applied for an office job, you see, for a shorthand typist. But he said, we have no vacancies and I can't see one coming up. He said, would you work in the factory? And I said, oh no, I said, my father wouldn't like that. See, I knew my father had paid the money for 3 years' education, you know, and it wasn't easy for him. I mean, there was only, well, by that time, of course, my brothers were working, two eldest brothers. But still, you know, you had to think of that. So I said, oh, no, my father wouldn't like that. And he said, oh, but he said, we're short of staff in the factory. Come on, I'll show you. And he brought me all around the factory. The manager, it was a Mr. Bean, Mr. Arthur Bean. He's there all his life. And he brought me all through the factory. And, of course, I was dressed up in my best. And afterwards, someone said to me, we never forgot you. You were brought through the factory before you got a job here. None of us were. And you had a beautiful coat on.
was it Mr. It was all very formal, was it?
And you see, he said, you can start on Monday. And this was Friday. And of course, I went home and told my mother. My father was away working. Because he would work around the country, you know, wherever. He worked for Mr. Humphrey Murphy for years, and he would send him because he neither drank nor smoked. So he depended on him, you see, to get the work done. And as I said, he was a perfectionist. So my father was away. So off I went into Orney. And when my father came home, he was disgusted. And I said, well, I'm not leaving. I love it.
What were you doing?
The first job I did there was sugaring jellies. Mm-hmm. That was my first job. And I loved it. And I was, they must have thought I was so good at that, but I was put into what they call, what was the name of our room? The marzipan was made there. And they made, what's this they call them? Oh, they were sweets that they were like, the centre of them was mixtures of different liqueurs like brandy and you know, all those liqueurs
yes.
would be in them.
The centerpiece.
The centers were the, yeah. You just broke the top off. They were in the shape of a bottle.
Yeah.
And you broke the top off and let yeah. whatever was in them down. Now, they were very, very expensive, but they were made there. And of course, I can't think of the name of the room now. It'll come to me. But we had a Belfast man over us by the name of Mr. Willie McCauley. And his accent was real Belfast, with the result that I used to say to some of the girls, "Will you listen to what he's saying to me, because I can't understand him." I couldn't understand his accent, you see. And I'd always make sure to have someone near me that had been there long before me and would have got used to his accent, you see. So I worked there, and then I was moved up to the packing department soon after that, because I had very cold hands always.
Yes.
And I was moved up to pack. And I was one of the people who packed 10 caskets. Now, caskets were big chocolate boxes, and they came out like a casket and went in, and there was a big tassel on them and ribbon and whatever. And we packed 10 of those, another girl and myself, for Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier when they came to Ireland. And she was visiting the hospital, the children's hospital in Crumlin for sick children. And we packed 10 caskets to go down there. She was being presented with them, or there was some big presentation on anyway, that they wanted these caskets. Ernie sent them down, because you see, it was promotion for them. Old Mr. Gallagher was always quick to see an opportunity to advertise Ernie chocolates. And you see, as soon as he heard she was coming there, he got in with these. He sent down 10 caskets of Ernie chocolates. What she did with them, I'd never heard.
What about working in that environment, the beautiful smell of the chocolate, and that must have been
lovely.
Very pleasant to work
in. Very pleasant, and you could eat them, of course, which was the best part. And you had to, they were very particular. You washed your hands, and there was a person in the toilet to make sure you washed your hands. Everybody had to wash their hands. It became automatic with you. No matter what you did, you would wash your hands after it. Even in your own room, there was a basin, and there'd be a square thing and the tap to wash your hands. And you automatically washed your hands after anything you did. They were so particular. You had to have your white coat, and it was buttoned to the neck with Ernie across there. And that was buttoned up to the neck and down below your knees. Every Monday morning, you daren't go in with a dirty coat. It wouldn't be tolerated.
What kind of a uniform were you wearing?
Well, that was it, your white coat. You could have anything under it.
Yes. And a hat?
And a little hat, like a nurse's cap. It was only a band there, and just sitting on your head. And you always had a little clip to clip it there in case it would fall off. But of course, it was very, it was lovely to wear. The uniform was lovely.
Where was the milk and everything that was needed to produce
the chocolate?
The chocolates. Where was that coming from?
That was there on the premises. Now, the milk came to what they called the milk house? No, it was like a platform where the milk came in, but it was beside the laboratory. They had their own laboratory, and the milk was checked there.
But who were the suppliers? Sorry.
What would you mean?
The people supplying the milk, people supplying the sugar, people supplying the... I'm sure it came in large quantities in from...
HB, I think, supplied the milk, as far as I remember. The cocoa beans, or they call the... I think Cocoa beans was a wrong name for it. It was a cassia tree that these beans came from. They came from Africa. They came from Africa in bags, and they were put into what they called the bean shed. And they were allowed, they'd be dried out, really. That was hot. Not real hot, but warm enough. And they would be dried out. And they would then be pounded down to make the chocolate in big vats. And the vat, excuse me, went around. There was like an arm in the inside, stirring it all the time. It was like automatic, big round, like
stirring that, it all up.
Yeah. And for the milk chocolate then, that the milk was put in for the milk chocolate. And of course sugar went in as well. And but the main thing, the start of it was the cocoa, what they call the cocoa bean, was ground down to make the chocolate.
And in all of that time, you were caught up in your own work, I suppose. You were looking after your mother too, were you, at that stage, or had your father?
Well, no, only when she became ill, like maybe with a very bad cold or a tummy upset, I'd stay at home for a day or two. That's what I mean.
You lived at home with your parents all the time.
Yes, I did.
And did any other members of your family stay at home as well?
Well, Evelyn was a lot at home as well. She would have been a lot. And she'd be the only one that would stay. Either she would stay or I would stay if one of us were required to stay at home. Because Cookstown, I suppose, was lonely as well. And if you were sick in bed, like, it'd be very lonely. So her or I would stay at home.
Mm-hmm. And when you look back now at all those years and you see all the most amazing changes have taken place, you can see all around you now how different it is. Do you think that it is? Are you comfortable living in the environment you're living in now? Or would you have preferred it the way it was?
Well, in some ways, it's better, because the square, I think, was a great achievement, or whatever I'd like to call it, to the people in the area. It was well built, a lovely building, and it, you know, you could buy anything you wanted there. In other ways, then, they allowed too many houses to be built, too many apartments, with the result that the square is dwarfed now by the high-rise apartments, 14, 15 stories high. To me, that was a disgrace for a small area like Tala. The village, to me, they ruined it by allowing commercial shops to be put into those beautiful cottages, two-story houses, granite fronted. They were beautiful. To me, Tala should have been kept like the village of Adair. And it would have been lovely. They had the priory on the opposite side, which never changes. And the priory wall was lovely, nice built wall. The priory was there from the Dominicans came in 1886. So it was always there for the people of Tala. And they looked after them. And anyone who didn't have a meal went to the priory and they got it. And to me, they ruined the village by allowing shops to come into it. And I don't know, I think it could have been better looked after. And they spend a lot of money, even at the present day, on things that could be achieved much cheaper. Now, to me, they spent a lot of money on paving around the monument, which they called the Women of Tala. It took 2 years to put a bit of paving around that. When there was a break for a long time, and I asked someone, why were they not continuing to do it? It was never finished to me. And I think it's only been finished now. They said the stone that they were using had to come from China.
Yes.
How I said, what is wrong with the stone in Ireland or whatever we have? That was one thing I didn't like. And things that they should look after, they're not looking after. Now, I'm coming to the present day now, and I say that when I heard on radio and television that Tala was the second dirtiest place in Ireland, I was very, very saddened to hear that. Tala was a lovely village at the foot of the Dublin Hills when I came out to live in Tala. It was beautiful. You had fresh air. You had all the graves, the Barrow grave, which is on the top of Sea Finn. You had a cairn on the top of Sea Finn On. You had Hellfire Club on the top of over by Old Bon. You had the Dolmen beside it. And all those things were there to be looked after by the local council. They didn't look after anything. The Barrow grave on Sea Finn, besides being a Barrow grave, there was also a miniature of the place down on the Boyne. I can't think of the Grange. And when I went to Newgrange to see it, it was exactly the same, only much bigger, of what we had on Sea Finn. Now, the Tala Historical Society, of which I was made a life member and was started by Mrs. Margaret Taylor, went several times and asked that the cairn, it was like a grave, the same as Newgrange, would be looked after. And it had a corbel roof, which had begun to fall in. Mm-hmm. Some of the stones in the centre had dropped down into it. Now, the five niches in the walls around were there perfectly, as if it was a miniature of Newgrange. And year after year after year, the stones fell in. And I don't know, the last time I was up there, it was almost unrecognisable. To me, that is, if other people had that, they would be going mad to look after it and the other county. But there we did nothing.
When you think it survived for thousands of years.
That's right.
And now
you wouldn't recognise it as being the same as Newgrange, only much, much smaller.
Well, Pat O'Neill, I'll tell you something. You're a great woman. You're, for your age, I must say, for your ability to continue and to fight your corner, really, indeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.